Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Thank God it's Friday. I hope everyone had a fantastic July 4th celebration. We had nonstop rain here in South Carolina, and I see Mike in the chat room said it was raining over by him. So I don't think we had the same storm, but holy moly, but we still got the fireworks in. So welcome to Southern Sense, another exciting adventure, along with me, your radio host, the radio chick, Annie. I forgot what my name was, along with my co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Well, good afternoon, Annie. It is great to be here. Well rested like you, and ready for a great edition of Southern Sense. For those who don't know, Annie's trying to deny the fact that she's doing this show slightly hungover, but we'll get through. No, down to the Southern people know how to do it right. They never do anything small when it comes to a barbecue or fireworks. It's all good, Annie. So. How good was that food at the barbecue you were at yesterday?
Oh, man. A friend of ours made a smoked prime rib. Oh, it was to die for. I mean, I must have eaten myself. If I were not who I am, I would probably weigh about 600 pounds. You know, the food was just that good. Oh man.
Well, great. It was a great celebration here up in Michigan. The weather was a little bit better than what obviously you went through, but it was the 4th of July. It was very, very special. I went to a parade. This is a neighborhood parade. It's been going on 79 years. A mile from my house, I had never heard of this parade. And I will tell you, it is the greatest, most patriotic parade you can imagine. But although I have never heard of it, Annie, listen to this. This is a neighborhood parade. So basically, within a mile or so radius, the neighborhood association. We had a U.S. senator there, a congressman, virtually any kind of politician below that you could imagine. Grand Rapids, the city of Grand Rapids, canceled their parade. I guess they couldn't compete. But it was amazing. The parade ended in somebody's backyard, and it wasn't that big backyard, but everyone crammed in, sang patriotic music. They had the raising of the flag. They had children dressed as the founding fathers, and it was really, really just an amazing experience. When I was telling my friends about this parade, they thought I was lying. They're like, well, wait a minute. We've lived here all our life. We never heard of this parade either. So we went online, and then pictures started appearing, you know, throughout the day that people were there. Wow. So, but that's what it's about. That's what it is all about, paying tribute to our country and our founding fathers.
Absolutely. You know, we have a parade here in downtown Beaufort that starts off downtown and ends up at the National Cemetery that has the buried dead from the Revolutionary through the Civil War through today. Matter of fact, a few friends of mine are now, unfortunately, resting there. God rest their souls. But, I mean, that's what it is. It's to remember what our roots are, you know, what our founders fought for and what we need to help preserve. And we need to spread that message. We really do need to spread that message.
One of the hosts of this parade, he recited the closing argument that the lawyer did in To Kill a Mockingbird, talking about rights and freedoms, and you could tell he was just gasping in his glory. He did it very, very well. But you know, lawyers, they love grandstanding. You know, they just. They just love to be in front of the crowd, and it just no wonder why a lot of them are judges and politicians.
Well, we hope everyone had a fantastic 4th of July, and, you know, tell your kids, your nephews, your neighbors just what the whole holiday is truly about, the founding of this nation. And as we said on our last show, I mentioned the Battle of Sullivan's Island, which is now Fort Moultrie. And how the Revolutionary Patriots were so vastly, vastly overwhelmed in numbers by the British, and yet they withstood the assault, and they became victorious. How Colonel Moultrie defended this fort that was halfway built of the trunks of palmetto trees. How 270 cannons fired upon that fort, and they withstood it. And how they became victorious against a superior force. Without that battle, July 4th never would have occurred, because the Continental Congress was afraid that we were going to lose the Revolutionary War. It was that battle that encouraged our founding fathers to sign the Declaration of Independence 6 days later. And we have to remember the sacrifices of these brave men and, yes, women, who fought to free our nation, and how we have to carry that battle standard forward.
Absolutely. Well put, Annie, well put. Maybe you ought to be a lawyer.
No, I have a sister who's an attorney, so I don't need to spread it in the family.
But it is. There's amazing intangibles that we really don't know about that led up to, you know, the Declaration of Independence and its signing, and there's so much in history we don't know. It really is amazing to learn it, and it really gives you a great appreciation for our founding fathers, as far as I'm concerned, and not only the sacrifices they made, but the individuals who were in the minority that took up arms to fight the British. Because as we all know, about 30% of America, about 30-35%, decided to fight the British, where the other 65% didn't. So thank God we won.
Absolutely. And in the past, we've given dedications to some Revolutionary War heroes. Today, we're giving a dedication to a hero that was killed back in 2003 in Iraq. Every show, we have been dedicating to a fallen hero. And today's dedication is going to go out to Army Private First Class Rachel K. Bosveld. So I don't know, Mike, if you're at your computer or not. Okay. If we can pull up the Army mix, and we will do this dedication. So So please
all
take
right.
a moment to remember this young woman.
This
is from Waupun, Michigan. I'm sorry, Wisconsin. The news of Rachel Bossel's death was brought the reality of the conflict in Iraq home to Waupun. Bosfield, a member of the 527th Military Police, was killed October 26, 2003, during a mortar attack at a Baghdad police station. As the word of the 19-year-old's death filtered through the community, friends who knew the fun-loving brunette sought out one another to grieve and relive memories spent with their fallen friend. Although Bosfield attended Waupun High School for only 2 years after transferring from Oshkosh West High School, it was clear she made a lasting impression on the lives of those who knew her. She was energetic and always laughing, said Chrissy Besk, Fond du Lac student and former classmate. When she first came to school, we just kind of pulled her into our circle and took her under our wing. Besk said that Bosfield was very independent and comfortable with who she was. She was really unique and had her own style, and wasn't embarrassed to show it, Besk said, who also tells of Bosfield's sense of humor. Sometimes we would just do silly stuff, like dress up like boys and then go out in public. After she learned of Bosfield's death, she spent time with a friend, Jessica Gruen, looking over old pictures of themselves and Bosfield in happier times. Because she had been away for so long, the news didn't really hit me at first. But when we began looking at old pictures and wishing she was here, it came over us big time, Besk said. Rachel was such a strong person, and I looked up to her. She knew what she wanted and where she wanted to go in life. I will always remember that about her. Marvin Bosfield sat on the couch and told the story of his daughter's short life. Marvin Bosfield and his former wife, Mary, were serving as foster parents when Rachel came to them as a neglected baby. The couple adopted her. After they separated, she lived in Oshkosh with her mother, but moved to Waupun with her father for her junior and senior years in high school. She enlisted in the Army when she graduated in June 2002, following in the footsteps of her father, who served in the Army in Italy from 1967 to 69, and Craig, who served in the Army in Alaska. She idolized her brother, Marvin Bosfield said, pointing to a photograph of Craig holding a toddler-sized Rachel in a tree branch. I had some reservation when because she was a girl. She asked me not to worry about it. She was as good as anyone. Her mother said she desperately tried to talk her daughter out of it. I would have done anything to have her choose a different career, Mary said. She said, I know, Mom, but I have to do this. I want to keep up the family tradition. Except, Mom, I'm going to be the first girl in our entire family. Rachel graduated from boot camp in October 2002. Her father rode his Harley-Davidson motorcycle to Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri to see her graduate. She asked for a ride on the back. That, Marvin said, was his last real memory of her. When she first got to Iraq, she was ready to kick butt, her father said. Until September 12th, that was the day a rocket-propelled grenade hit the Humvee she was driving. Craig Bosfield said the Humvee burned up from inside. His sister dislocated her shoulder trying to open the door. When she did free herself, her unit started taking small arms fire until another Humvee arrived to help. From then on, her father said, her opinion changed. She counted the days when she could leave in her letters. One focused on all the dead and abused horses she saw in Baghdad. Another talked about anti-American riots and people chanting, USA, go home. She transferred from night patrol to day patrol. She hoped she might live longer that way, Craig Bosfield said. Mary Bosfield said her daughter wrote to her and asked her for newspapers in Wisconsin to do a story in the real hardships of the troops facing over there. She got three letters from her daughter Tuesday, the day after the family learned she had been killed. Mom, don't worry so much about me, one letter said. Mary Bosfield said Rachel hoped to write a book about her experiences. Now she has to pass on her daughter's story to reporters as much as she hates it, she said. I'm doing this for Rachel because it's her story. Marvin Bosfield said the hardest part for him We'll be dealing with the unopened birthday cards when they return. Rachel would have turned 20. She kept assuring me she was getting her sleep, staying alert, keeping her head down and looking over her shoulder. I can hardly believe it yet. That was my daughter. The show is dedicated to the memory of Rachel Bosfeld and to all men and women who have served, who are serving, and who will serve. This song is dedicated to them. My Name is America by Todd Allen Herndon.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger and I'll rise up from the flames. Taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt,
sorry about that. It got cut off really short. Well, Mike, we got ourselves a rock and roll and good show going on here today. I'm sorry about the song being cut off. I guess it's a little beachy off flute. Yes, it really,
that was a great dedication, by the way, Annie. That was a great tribute.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about these young people that go forward into battle because we ask them to, who give up everything and sacrifice everything for the values and freedoms that we believe in. You know, God bless every single one of them. And they deserve the honor. They deserve every ounce of the honor. And speaking of which, we got to remind everyone, it's not just the 4th of July holiday weekend, but it's also the 150th anniversary of the battles at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. So remember these men and women that fought for our freedoms. We got a great guest here today, and want to bring on board Gordon Chang, who is a contributor to Forbes magazine. He's a best-selling author. He's got a well-known book called The Coming Collapse of China, which he wrote back in 2001. And I want to welcome aboard Gordon Chang. Good afternoon, Mr. Chang.
Good afternoon.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. And we've got a great audience sitting in the chat room and listening online. And I'm glad that you have joined us this holiday weekend.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Now, back in... Go ahead, Mike.
Is he a little low, Annie? His voice is a little low?
His voice is a little bit low. I don't know if you have a volume control on your phone or if you can become closer to your speaker.
I will do my best.
Okay. We're
you
just having
go first,
fun.
Annie, or for me?
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, basically, I was looking at your website and I was studying the question and answers. And one of them is, I didn't quite understand, one of your books is The Coming Collapse of China. And I'm sure you've been asked this 8 billion times. What do you mean collapse? Such as imploding, like details of what your the collapse would consist of.
What I mean is a failure of the Communist Party. So I believe that at some point the Communist Party will fail. Now, in my book, I said it would occur within 10 years, which means the middle of 2011. So I'm a little bit off. But what we've seen with the real problems in the Chinese economy over the last several months, I think that these are going to only worsen, and they're going to have political consequences so that the party will not be able to maintain control of Chinese society.
Now, what I found amazing is that you're predicting this back in 2001, and I noticed a lot of news articles that have been buried like in the back pages about 3 years ago that involved the housing bust, involved in banking, involving the what you call the Immortal Eight. And it, I guess 3 years ago would make it 2010. And I was noticing the implosion then, but not a lot of the media is talking about it.
Well, right now, more and more people are, because the problems evident in the economy are now becoming so much clearer. And I think that essentially we are going to see over the next 6 months a real downturn like we saw in the U.S. in 2008 and in Europe as well. Because the, right now the Chinese economy doesn't make sense. It has got a debt crisis. It is a slowing manufacturing. And when you look at all of this, it just means that they will not be able to pay back their debts, and that's going to have catastrophic consequences.
But how is our dollar tied into this now?
Well, the Chinese hold about $3.4 trillion worth of foreign reserves, which is not all in dollars. They hold about $1.3 trillion in U.S. Treasury obligations. And that amount has stayed pretty much constant since July 2011. So China has not been funding our deficit spending, which means that we can get along without China. Now, I'm not saying we should be deficit spending, but I am saying that we do not depend on China to fund the federal government's deficits.
So, in other words, we shouldn't be afraid if China collapses?
Absolutely. You know, China has grown tremendously, but that doesn't mean China's been an engine of global growth, as everybody says. China has been growing because it has predatory policies, which has been taking growth away from other countries, including the U.S. To be an engine of global growth, you've got to buy the manufactured goods of other countries to create growth elsewhere. And China has been doing exactly the opposite. Now, there will be panic because a lot of people believe that China is going to dominate the 21st century. And when it falls apart, people are going to be shocked. So that will create dislocations in the global financial markets. But it wouldn't if we understood much better the relationship between China and the rest of the world and the real problems in the Chinese economy.
Does this have anything to do with I read a story last week, a lot of Chinese labor workers basically trapped one of the presidents of the company, and I believe he's a U.S. guy, basically saying that the money they're paying was unbounced, and that the company in China owes these Chinese workers lots of back pay, and some people haven't been paid. Does that have anything to do with what we're talking about?
That's sort of a separate situation. That involved a Florida medical services supply company on the outskirts of Beijing, which has actually the company's president was there. He was transferring one of the divisions to Mumbai in India. The Chinese workers became upset. They thought that he was going to close down everything. And so essentially they trapped him for about 6 or 7 days in his office. What this has to say, though, is that low-end manufacturing is leaving China. China's becoming a rust belt in many portions of the country. And also the country has a growth model which is no longer appropriate for today, and that's causing many of the problems we see. And the Chinese government and Chinese workers are blaming foreigners because they have nobody else to blame, and they can't blame themselves, which is what they really should be doing.
Well, that is true, and there's rampant corruption among a lot of the businesses and political leaders. So, you know, the dollars that should be going into the business is actually being spread around in graft.
Absolutely. China is one of the most corrupt societies on earth. They've been having anti-corruption campaigns in China since 1951, just 2 years after the founding of the People's Republic. That's 62 years ago. And the problem of corruption is getting worse and worse. And the reason is because the Communist Party completely refuses to consider political reform. You have an unaccountable political system. You have a government that is too much involved in the economy. And when you have those two together, you're going to have incredible amounts of corruption, which means that even low-level officials are millionaires in China, and upper-level officials are billionaires. So essentially, there's a problem there, and they have no way of solving it. Corruption is getting worse and worse, and that just is one of the signs of the end of the political system, because corruption always accompanies the end of dynasties in China.
So now, is this somewhat a Soviet Union-type collapse, where they're just spending way too much, or is this a different type collapse? From an economic standpoint?
Well, it's different in the sense that the Soviet Union failed from an economic point of view with decades of stagnation and low growth. China has had 35 years of virtually uninterrupted growth. Many of those years were double-digit growth. But China right now has a deceleration from double-digit growth in 2010 to really about 1 or 2% growth today. That is very difficult for any economy to absorb. China now has a debt crisis. Soviet Union didn't really have a debt crisis. So it's a very different type of crisis than the Soviet Union had. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's always problems with authoritarianism. They manifest themselves in different ways, and that's what we have, you know, in China today.
Now, it's funny because you're talking about, you know, there's a limited number of people that become billionaires that are in power. But Bloomberg did an extensive report on the so-called eight immortals. Who are they and what are these families?
Well, the eight immortals refer to former leaders of the People's Republic at the time that it was founded. These were the elders who worked with Mao Zedong. And many of those families have become extremely wealthy. And largely it's because of the problems in the political system that have allowed people to translate political power into economic power. And they've been able to appropriate a lot of the benefits from China's growth from the public sector into their private family wealth. This is the corruption that we were talking about, and which is getting worse and worse. And so I think when you look at these things, you have the current leader, Xi Jinping. His family is extremely wealthy. You had the family of former Premier Wen Jiabao, who New York Times tracked had about $2.7 billion of wealth that they could find in public records, and probably a lot more beyond that. So essentially you have a political class which has been able to appropriate economic benefits for themselves, and for the and that's, of course, to the detriment of the Chinese people. This is a highly corrupt group of people. It's almost a kleptocracy. People call it a mafia state, and yet we invite these leaders to our country and dignify them. We should really be viewing them and putting them on an Interpol list because they are corrupt. They are thieves, and they're also terrible violators of human rights.
So yeah, what happens to the debt we have? Well, with the debt we have with China, if they collapse, what happens to our debt that we owe them? How does that work?
Well, nothing happens. I mean, we have debt which is in our own currency, so we can always pay it off. It is fixed maturity, so, you know, it comes due when it comes due. And the Chinese probably will have to sell it into the global markets, which means other people will acquire it. But just because the Chinese state fails doesn't mean we have a debt problem. As I mentioned, since July 2011, China's official holdings of U.S. Treasury debt have remained basically constant at $1.3 trillion. Actually, now they're a little bit less at $1.25 trillion. So, you know, China has not been funding our debt and our deficit spending. So I don't think we really have to worry about that from the debt perspective.
Well, I hope so, because the way our current government is handling our deficit is absolutely frightening, absolutely frightening at all. You know, some of the things I was reading about, you wrote about a dot-com bubble in China, and we keep on talking about certain industries being moved over to China. Is something else to be afraid?
Well, you know, I actually don't think so, not right now, because essentially Chinese manufacturing has gotten too expensive. And for various reasons, China's manufacturing sector is becoming uncompetitive in global markets. And so we've seen, especially at the lower end, a lot of factories move to places like Vietnam, India, Bangladesh. And also at the same time, we've seen manufacturing start to move back to the U.S., where we're becoming much more competitive for various reasons, including cheap energy. Boston Consulting Group has done a survey which says that in seven critical manufacturing sectors, the U.S. will essentially become as cost-effective as the Chinese in about 2015. So this is a very good story for the United States. It's a very bad story for China.
All right. Now, China has that one-child rule, but they have a problem with that. Their population's actually decreasing instead of increasing like everyone predicted.
Yeah, well, right now, people had predicted, and if you go on the UN website, which is basically China's numbers with some UN modifications, shows that the Chinese economy peaking around 2035, maybe a little bit later. But Chinese leaders now themselves in public statements have said that the country's total population will peak around 2020, which means it probably will peak before then. But what's more important is that the Chinese workforce peaked in 2010. It's now getting smaller, and that is really critical. So you have the acceleration of adverse demographic trends because of largely the one-child policy. This really means that China, you know, it might not fail because of demographic reasons, but demographic reasons are making it very difficult for the economy to grow and essentially for China to prosper and for China to progress. It's got to progress in spite of demographic reasons, not because of them. If we look back at the last 3.5 decades, China grew in large part because of the demographic dividend, which was this extraordinary bulge in the workforce. Well, that's over, and now demographics is a headwind for China, not a tailwind.
Oh, wow. It's amazing, because all the things you're reading about in mainstream media is saying exactly opposite of what you are. What I found amazing was in the last presidential race, you had someone like Donald Trump touting the Chinese and their economic system. And meanwhile, a bunch of us are just looking at him and shaking our head and going, what are you looking at? Are you looking at the same thing that we are? And what is this love affair they have with the Chinese system?
Well, you know, it's not so much Donald Trump, because Donald Trump advocates a very different type of a relationship with China than this administration or the one before it has pursued. But essentially you have a lot of sell-side institutions, you know, Goldman Sachs, Wall Street institutions, that make money off the relationship with China. So they sort of push this very optimistic view of the way China's been going. But in the last 3 or 4 months, people have started to change their mind because they can see all of the problems are manifesting themselves in Chinese society and the Chinese economy. And this is becoming a very bad story. Last month in China, there were 2 waves of bank defaults. We saw all sorts of problems. They basically have a liquidity crisis, which they can't solve. And they really don't know what to do. At the same time, they've got a very discontent society. People have rising expectations, and the leadership, political leadership, can't meet it. So this is not a good story, because we're going to see a China which looks very different than the one we see today. And that new China is not very far down the road, maybe just a matter of months.
Now, it's funny, because I pulled up a recent article. Matter of fact, this was only written 2 days ago. This was in, what the heck was this in? It was in Forbes. Rafael Bostic wrote this. And I read his article, and I'm going, obviously this man has never talked to you, because he's touting the beautiful office towers and the condominium high-rises going up. They may be empty, but not close to capacity. And he's saying, oh, wow, China has this huge building boom, and they are so wonderful. I'm thinking, are you aware of how many of those are actually empty cities? And this is something that no one's talking about, the corruption in the building business, where these cities are going up, but no one's in them.
Yeah, well, these are the so-called ghost cities, where essentially there is a building boom. There's no doubt about that. But as you point out, these buildings are empty. So, for instance, right now, because of the very skewed nature of incentives in the Chinese economy, people have been buying apartments and keeping them vacant. They're using them as a store of value. So, in other words, instead of buying gold coins, they've been buying apartment units. There is this bubble in the Chinese construction industry. Essentially, it takes 4 decades for the average Chinese worker to buy a flat, which is 1,100 square feet. That is completely unsustainable. My wife and I went back to my dad's hometown, which is a place called Wugou, which is near Shanghai, and they turned it into a ghost city with all of these empty apartment buildings, empty skyscrapers, a stadium big enough for an NFL franchise, and these very broad boulevards, which are lined with densely packed streetlights. But there are no people there. And this is really going to be the problem that we see throughout China, where they've built this country, which is much bigger than China is, and they need people. But as we've just discussed, the Chinese population is going to peak in a few years. They don't have the ability to service the debt that they incurred in order to fuel this construction boom.
Now, what I was also finding was a recent article you wrote about China's Maoist vision, the city of 260 million people. And I'm reading this and I'm going, gee, Agenda 21 has just hit China. Has it?
Well, yes. I mean, Chinese technocrats believe that because, you know, they look at other countries like the United States and they see that, you know, like 70 or 80% of our population lives in urban areas. And because we have a very high contribution of consumption to our economy. Consumption plays a very important part of our economy. They believe that if they urbanize in China, consumption will play an important part in the Chinese economy too. And the reason that this is important is because every Chinese technocrat understands that consumption is much too low in China. It's unsustainably low. But, you know, this is silly because the reason why we have vibrant urban cities, in urban areas in our country, and the reason why we have a high rate of consumption is because these cities have grown organically. In China, they want to create cities by fiat, which has really been the main problem of the Chinese economy in the first place, where they think that they just because they order something to be done, it will be economically sustainable. Well, it won't be. So they're talking about creating cities of 260 million people, and yet this is nuts. This is absolutely stupid. And this is just another Maoist vision of, you know, you have a vision of Mao Zedong telling the Chinese people this is what they have to do. Now, Mao's been dead since 1976, but that same theory of governing has not died. And unfortunately, we see the same sort of centrally directed planning in China that existed from the very first years of the People's Republic.
What I find amazing is that, you know, China is such a vast country, and a lot of it is agricultural. So if you force these people into the cities, who's going to do the farming?
Well, that's another issue. China's agricultural sector is very inefficient. And so Chinese technocrats look at the United States and they see these big corporate farms and they think that they can do the same thing in China. Well, maybe they can, but probably they can't. But what they want to do is move about 250 million people off the farms into urban areas. And they think that they can create vibrant cities and have sustainable agriculture at the same time. But they really can't for a number of reasons. China's agriculture is very different in structure than ours, and also ours developed because it was the economically sensible thing to do. People in China just won't develop the same model, largely because it won't work in China's topography. It's just a very different system. But Chinese leaders think that they can overcome all of these by central government diktats, and unfortunately they can't. You cannot run an economy by fiat these days. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't. And, you know, as you said, we grew our economy organically where we saw a need and then we filled that need. Instead, they are forcing a false need, I think. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly.
No, you're saying it absolutely correctly. You know, China right now is a very unbalanced economy. Consumption contributes maybe 35% of gross domestic product. That's the lowest rate of contribution of consumption in the world. You know, in no economy does consumption play a smaller role. And what the Chinese are trying to do is to get that number to something which is normal. In most societies, consumption plays anywhere between 50 to 70% in the economy. Now, China just can't change its growth model overnight, and it can't do it without substantial reforms. And unfortunately, the political system will not allow those reforms to be implemented. So China basically has a political system that does not allow the change that needs to occur.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I was reading one of your articles about the coming cash crash, and I'm reading it, and I'm going, gee, are they talking to the current administration and following the same economic mold? Because I'm looking at their cash crunch and their false influence on the cash economy and the People's Bank of China. And I'm going, they're doing the same thing that we're doing. And it's only going to cause a devaluation of their currency and an absolute crash.
Yeah, well, Nina, I'm not going to defend the economic policies of either this administration or the last one, and I certainly don't like what Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is doing. But China's policies are even worse than ours for a number of reasons. Essentially, they're continuing an economic model which has been dictated from the center, from Beijing. It is not appropriate for China today. And unfortunately, their real problem is they've been creating debt, and they've been creating debt faster than they can pay it off. And, you know, I know we're doing the same thing, but they're doing it at an even faster pace than we are. So just to give you, for instance, our debt-to-gross domestic product ratio is terrible. It's about 105%. Theirs is about 210%, and it's going to reach about 245% in 2 years. That is completely unsustainable. And yet you have the Goldman Sachs of the world, you have many of these investment banks and China analysts are praising the China's economic model, and yet they are doing the same things that the rest of the world did, which caused the problems in 2008, 2009, except China is doing them more enthusiastically.
Yeah, what I found amazing is that some of the banks have actually suspended lending, and that is one of the worst things you can possibly do.
Yes. Chinese banks will not be making new loans until July 15th. By then, it'll be about 3 weeks that they have gone out of the lending business. We've seen Chinese banks, including the largest bank, which is Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, basically couldn't pay customers through their ATMs. And so they basically shut down their ATM system so that they could conserve cash. Not only did the largest bank in China did this, other banks in China have done it as well. And this just shows the seriousness of the cash shortage in China. And this, of course, is going to lead to a crash. I don't know exactly when, but certainly I think sometime this year we are going to see essentially a failure of the Chinese economy, and it probably will be catastrophic.
Yeah. What also amazed me is that you were citing that some of the banks were actually going to loan sharks and to online microfinance sites. I mean, to a loan shark to finance a bank?
Well, that's what's going on in China right now, which shows you the seriousness of the situation. The big banks have been having problems, but the smaller banks' problems are even worse. And you have the smaller banks borrowing from loan sharks. They've also been borrowing money at about a 50% annual percentage rate from these online microfinance sites, which shows you how serious the cash crunch is.
It does. Now, what I find amazing is that you were talking about customers not being able to get money out of the ATMs. No one's heard about this, but yet when Greece had the same situation, it was plastered all over the news. So, you know, is our media being complacent in assisting China in this?
Well, there's a certain amount of that, but also we've got to remember that Greece is a democracy. And all democracies, including ours, are very good at exposing their problems. Authoritarian systems like China are very good at hiding problems. And so, therefore, you know, for instance, when the Soviet Union fell, that took people by surprise, took almost everybody by surprise. You know, even our Central Intelligence Agency had been overestimating the output of the Soviet economy, not only for years, but for decades. This is the problem. When you have an authoritarian society, you don't have transparency, you don't have the clarity, and so therefore they are able to hide problems for a very long time. You know, we in democracies love to expose our problems because we have competitive political systems where people have an incentive to, in other words, to highlight difficulties because people want to get elected. They want to sort of show how bad the government is doing. And so we expose our problems. And that's why in Greece we learned about all these things, whereas in China most of these problems occurred and the media, not only our media, but of course Chinese media, didn't talk about them.
Now, I want to change the subject just a little bit here. How did you know that Snowden was going to end up in China?
Didn't quite know that he would end up in China, but once he went to Hong Kong, it was clear that he was cooperating with Chinese intelligence because, you know, Hong Kong has an extradition agreement with the United States, and Hong Kong's law enforcement authorities have a history of close cooperation with ours. So going to Hong Kong is the last place that Snowden should have gone to. The reason he went there was because he thought that China, Beijing, would protect him. And so, therefore, once he went to China, it was very clear. Went to Hong Kong. It was very clear that he was cooperating with Chinese intelligence. And in fact, what we have learned since Snowden went to Hong Kong is extremely troubling. That he has turned over very valuable information, either directly and sometimes indirectly, to the Chinese.
A lot of us have cheered him on, saying thank you for exposing the fact that you're snooping on American citizens unconstitutionally, but yet at the same time, he's damaged the United States. So, you know, what side of the fence, you know, should we actually stand on? Should we be cheering him for exposing the information to the American people, or should we be booing him for giving it the information to our enemies?
Well, I think you can do a little bit of both. You know, Snowden has raised some very important issues about the surveillance of the American people by the American government. Now, I think Snowden was essentially a traitor. I think that he was either working for the Chinese or he was working alongside the Chinese, which means we should also condemn him for disclosing those secrets to the enemies of the United States. Both of these issues exist at the same time. Just because Snowden's motives were bad doesn't mean that everything that Snowden did harms the United States. Certain things he did, I think, were very important because he did start a national conversation about surveillance. But nonetheless, he didn't do that because he was a whistleblower. He did that because he wanted to hurt. I think his motives were bad. And so we now know that he's done a lot of things to help Beijing and a lot of things to harm the United States. But that doesn't mean the issue of surveillance of Americans by the NSA should go away. We should still talk about it. It's just that we shouldn't hold out Snowden as a hero. His motives, I think, were evil. But that doesn't mean, as I said, that we shouldn't talk about the things that he's raised.
I agree.
Can I throw in a question, Annie?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, all that happens, okay? We wake up in the morning, overnight, all. Then what politically, as far as do they, I mean, what from there? I mean, because I think the actual mind is, okay, this all happens. All of a sudden you have a republic now, voters and county commissioners and city commissioners and governors.
Excuse me, I didn't catch that.
Mike, you dropped off.
Oh, I'm sorry, I did?
Yeah.
Oh, all right, my question, sir, was, okay, all of this happens. We wake up in the morning and the structure has collapsed or imploded. All of a sudden, do they have a republic? I mean, free elections and kind of like... Yes.
Yeah, well, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, China could go any number of different ways. You know, everybody wants to see it gradually evolve to a liberal democracy, you know, some form of representative governance. And, you know, that's just universal. But nonetheless, just because everyone wants that to happen doesn't mean it will happen. The history of China is essentially that every change of government has been bloody, has created a lot of turbulence and chaos, and has essentially been bad for China in the sense that there have been periods of complete disorganization. You know, we've seen this as dynasties fall. We saw that when the Qing dynasty, the last dynasty, failed in the 1911. We saw when the Republic of China, Chiang Kai-shek, failed in 1949. So I think it's safe to say that we will see a period of turbulence, uncertainty, and it's going to be, I think, a very difficult thing for China to go through. But eventually China has to do that because it has a political system that is completely inappropriate for the 21st century.
Now, what I find amazing is that we as Americans tend to impose our value system on other countries. You know, we don't put ourselves in their mindset. So what we need to do is actually think the way that the Chinese think. You know, they'll sit there quietly and wait for something to occur, whereas we are more proactive. We are a society that was based upon a growth of freedoms, you know, from the British monarchy to what we are now. It has been centuries of evolution, whereas the Chinese society has been one of always an imperialism. So it's hard for us to envision anything beyond what we know, is what basically what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, I think that's true for most people. You know, we have this vision of China, and it's been essentially 35 years of strong economic growth and more or less political stability. But that doesn't mean it's going to continue forever. And the problem is that we now see the evidence in Chinese society of reasons why the government could fail. And we're also seeing reasons that the economy will fail. So this is a point where China's reached about the limit of what it can do within its current political system. And we can no longer extrapolate. You know, everyone sort of extrapolates. We always think that tomorrow is going to be just like today, and that's sort of natural. But there are points in history where things, you know, just go off the rails, and we are at that point with regard to China.
No, that it is possible. Now, I found also rather amusing that the Chinese, are, as they're coming into this crisis, are also flexing their muscles with their now joint naval drill with Russia. And are they doing this for show, or is this something we should be concerned about?
We should definitely be concerned about it because remember the Communist Party has primarily based its legitimacy on the continual delivery of prosperity. When China can no longer assure prosperity for the Chinese people. The only basis of legitimacy will be nationalism. And so China has been extremely aggressive over the last couple of years as it's tried to grab territory from an arc of nations, from India in the south to South Korea in the north. And the Chinese and the Russians getting together is something of great concern for us because those are two very large states. You've got to remember that the United States won the Cold War in large part because we pried China away from the Russians. And so at the end, the Soviets were not able to prevail. It would be really bad for us if the Chinese and the Russians got together and formed a coalition against us. Now, I don't think that that will happen for a number of reasons, but nonetheless, we have to be concerned about that possibility because both of them are pretty powerful nations.
Yeah, they are. And what is disturbing is now they're making overtures to other countries such as Pakistan. Matter of fact, this week, the Pakistani Prime Minister Sharif is going over there.
Well, China and Pakistan have been friends for a very long time. The reason why Pakistan has nuclear weapons, for instance, is not because they developed them on their own. It's because the Chinese helped their program from the very beginning. And they did that in Beijing because they wanted to develop a counterweight against India, because China saw India as being another large Asian nation and therefore an adversary. So essentially, the Chinese created the nuclear state of Pakistan, and then Pakistan, with China's blessings, proliferated nuclear weapons technology to many nations, including North Korea and Iran. We also see the Syrian nuclear weapons program as an outgrowth indirectly of the Chinese program. So China has been sending the most dangerous technologies around the world to accomplish its foreign policy goals. And we need people in Washington to understand this. We got to remember that both Republicans and Democrats have had essentially an incorrect view of China. As a matter of fact, the Republican policies towards China have been worse than the policies of the Democratic Party. But we need to have a national conversation about this because the Chinese are spreading nuclear weapons technology. This threatens vital security interests of the United States and threatens the lives of Americans. And unfortunately, people in Washington, both Republicans and Democrats, are not willing to talk about what I think is the most critical threat to the American homeland.
That is very, very true, because it concerned me when I saw that President Clinton was selling computer technology to China and North Korea, and no one, you know, blew any whistle on that. It's like, oh, all right, it's harmless. No, it's not harmless.
It's not harmless at all. And, you know, we have seen his predecessor, George W. Bush, watch the North Koreans transfer all sorts of dangerous technologies to the Iranians and not say anything about it. And, of course, the Obama administration has continued with our feckless policies. So we need to have a better policy in Washington. As I said, this is not a partisan complaint. Both parties have been almost equally at fault at this, and both parties have failed to protect the American people.
That is only oh so true. Because I was reading about now China's challenging Japan over various things, like a gas field. There's certain islands that are in dispute. There's also the memory chip that's going back and forth between Toshiba and China. But no one's talking about these things.
Well, no one's talking about them because we are afraid to confront China, because we believe that the Chinese own the 21st century, that, you know, we're in hock to them, all the rest of it. But those beliefs are untrue. I think that we're going to be worrying a year from now for about a weak China rather than a strong one, and we need to have better policies, because if we don't have better policies, we are going to have perhaps some of the worst outcomes possible.
That is, it is. We have to start paying attention. And one of the things that we rely on is Chinese influence over North Korea. Anytime North Korea starts rattling its saber, we go running to China to rein them in.
Absolutely. And then the Chinese are ruthlessly pragmatic, and they obtain concessions from us because whenever they say they're going to help, they've never been very helpful. Matter of fact, the Chinese have given the North Koreans the one thing that they really needed most to make themselves a threat to the international community, and that is time. the Chinese have prevented us basically from acting against North Korea. In the Bush administration, the administration of George W. Bush, looked to China to rein in the North Koreans. That was absolutely the wrong thing to do because the Chinese saw this as an opportunity to help North Korea and hurt the international community.
Yeah, now we've got a little bit of a dispute over this Kenneth Bay. This was a guy who was over there who was a tour guide. He's an American, a tour guide, but now he's being accused of espionage and treason and all these other things. What's the status on him?
Well, he is now, I believe, in a hard labor camp. He received a sentence of 15 years, I believe. And I think that, well, actually a couple of days ago, he appealed to the international community to help free him. At this point, he's probably being used as a bargaining chip by the North Koreans. And unfortunately, we're probably going to give in. But, you know, we've done this before. We did this with the two reporters from Current TV. We've done this with other people who have gone to North Korea. And we have allowed them to become bargaining chips. So the North Koreans, of course, naturally, take more bargaining chips when they see that we're willing to deal.
Well, what are they looking to bargain for?
All sorts of things. But essentially they want more aid. They want to be recognized as a nuclear weapons state. They want us to remove sanctions that are on North Korea. They basically want us to give them everything that they could possibly ask for. And unfortunately, we have been all too willing in the past to talk to the North Koreans and give them what they want.
All right. Now, a friend of mine wrote an article just the other day in Roll. His name is Chet Nagel. And he wrote that North Korea is no paper tiger. And it was an excellent item. But, you know, why is it that our government treats North Korea as if it's a paper tiger when there's actually a true threat there?
I think because North Korea is a very difficult foreign policy challenge, and we have always been able to put it at the bottom of our list of priorities. So we have never really devoted the attention necessary to getting rid of the regime, which I think is the only way we're going to solve the North Korean problem, because the Kim regime, decade in and decade out, has shown that it is unable to deal in good faith with the international community. So we've sort of put this into the too-hard-to-file basket and have let the North Koreans become real threats. Because as we've done this, they have developed long-range ballistic missiles and nuclear warheads. And so they are now able to hold the international community to ransom. And that's what the North Koreans are doing. And we have let them do it. So while we're not responsible for the North Korean regime, we have, through very bad decisions in Republican and Democratic administrations, allowed the North Koreans to threaten us. It's in many ways our fault.
That is very, very true, because recently they went in and fired upon a South Korean island, killing South Koreans. They've torpedoed a South Korean vessel, a military vessel. But we haven't responded, and I don't understand why we have not responded.
Yes, in 2010, the North Koreans killed 50 South Koreans, 46 of them when they sunk a South Korean frigate, and four people when they shelled Yongpin Island, which you referred to. And yet the United States essentially did nothing, largely because we wanted to keep the peace on the Korean Peninsula and just hoped that the whole issue would go away. And also because we allowed China to support North Korea. And so, therefore, we allowed the Chinese, who are North Korea's only military ally, actually, in fact, they're each other's only military ally, we allowed the Chinese to support the North Koreans. This has really been a bad North Korea policy and a very bad China policy. And that's why I think...
No, it's true. And I'm watching a lively debate going on inside our chat. People who are listening in are having a debate over... And that actually have EMPs, and do the North Koreans also have EMPs? That's the impulse bombs.
Electromagnetic pulse. Yeah, I don't think that they have at this point, but for them to develop it is not going to be too much further beyond their capability. within about 3 or 4 years, they will be able to land a nuclear weapon at any point in the United States. If they can do that, they can develop an EMP weapon. So, you know, essentially, I don't think they have it now, but it's just a matter of 2 or 3 years where they will be able to develop something like that.
Now, we called Iran and North Korea the axis of evil. Is North Korea actively working with Iran?
Well, absolutely it is. We know that the Iranians and the North Koreans, for more than a decade, have had a joint nuclear weapons program and a joint ballistic missile program, which is essentially the North Koreans develop the technology and they sell it to the Iranians. Remember in 2007, in September, the Israelis destroyed a nuclear reactor in the Syrian desert. Well, that reactor was paid for by Iran. We have seen the North Koreans sell processed uranium. We've seen them sell ballistic missiles. We know that the Iranians have been on site for all the North Koreans' long-range missile tests as well as their nuclear weapons tests. This is not this is something which is actually well known at this point. So clearly the two countries are thick as thieves when it comes to the world's most dangerous weapons and technologies.
Well, what can we do about it?
Well, there are a couple things that we need to do. First of all, we need to make sure that the North Koreans don't sell any more of this stuff to the Iranians. And that, unfortunately, means the United States is going to have to take some pretty drastic measures, such as, for instance, making sure that North Korean ships don't go to Iran. Now, we have the capability to do this. We don't have the will. We don't have the will to tell the Chinese that we will sanction them and sanction them hard for helping the North Koreans. We should do this. This is a matter of our own security, but neither political party is willing to take the steps necessary to protect us. And so I think that this is a failure on our part. So that's the first thing we need to do. Second thing, we need to tell the Chinese they've got a choice. They can either be the friends of the North Koreans or they can be our friends, but they can't be both. Unfortunately, we've allowed them to be friends of both. In other words, we've tried to help the Chinese at the same time the Chinese have helped the North Koreans. This is absolutely wrong policy. We need to change it. We need to tell the Chinese they have no choice. And right now, with the very fragile economy in China, we have the special leverage over the Chinese. Last year, the Chinese ran a record trade surplus against the United States of $315.1 billion. That was 136.3% of their overall trade surplus. That's an incredible number. That shows their dependence on the United States. So we need to start acting and using this as leverage.
All right. Now, someone in the chat room is writing that Kim Jong-un is, you know, a coward. He's not someone we should fear. But I actually think he's the exact opposite. He looks cute and cuddly, but he's extremely dangerous.
He's very dangerous right now. And the reason he's dangerous is because at no time since 1948, 1949, when North Korea was formed, has a North Korean leader had a smaller base of support than Kim Jong-un does today, which means that there is disorganization in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, which essentially means that Kim Jong-un probably will be doing things to try to shore up his support with the military. And that means that Kim Jong-un will engage in provocations, in dangerous provocations. So I think that we're seeing the results of a weak North Korea, and unfortunately it is a very dangerous North Korea.
Now, I also noticed that South Korea has been making overtures into new talks. Is there something to hope for, or are they doing this just to slide?
I'm actually very concerned about this because the South Koreans throughout various times have supported the North Korean economy. And right now the talks are over the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which is essentially 123 South Korean-owned factories just a little bit north of the demilitarized zone, which separates the two Koreas. This provides a lot of source of wealth to the North Korean regime. And so the North Koreans had closed down the Kaesong Industrial Complex. They did that a few months ago. Now the South Koreans want to open it up again and therefore support the North Korean government. There's nothing that we can do right now to convince the South Koreans not to do this, but we should do all within our power to make sure that that industrial zone does not get reopened.
Why is that industrial zone so bad?
Well, because it supplies a lot of support for the economy of North Korea. And North Korea can continue to develop nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles if it has the money to do so. And this industrial complex supplies a lot of that money, which is then used by the regime to develop weapons of mass destruction. So we should be trying to strangle the North Korean economy. And the best place to start is making sure that the Kaesong industrial complex remains closed.
Now, we've been hearing stories slowly slipping out about North Koreans that are now refugees. They go through China and then seek refugee status in countries like the United States. Are we going to see more of their citizens becoming dissatisfied and seeking change?
I think that we will, because largely not only is the North Korean economy pretty awful, but more important, more and more sources of outside information are starting to seep into North Korea. North Koreans are starting to understand how bad their situation is, and because of that, they're becoming more discontented. If you remember the movie The Truman Show, the story of a man who grew up in basically an alternate reality. He didn't know anything about the outside world. Well, that's essentially the North Koreans in the first years of North Korea, which was founded in 1948. But as the North Koreans know more about what's going on, they start to see that they're not living in the paradise that the Kim regime has been telling them that they live in. And what we need to do is encourage the North Koreans to understand how bad their situation is.
Yeah, and that's the absolute truth, because my uncle, my mother's brother, was serving in a MASH unit in Korea during the Korean War. Some of the stories he put back was mind-boggling, but now when you look at it today, it's even worse than it was back then. I mean, sheer starvation of their own people.
Yes, I mean, and this is really horrific. I mean, Kim Jong-un is, as his father before him and his grandfather before that, these are people who have had no sympathy at all for the North Korean people, who starved them, sometimes deliberately, and essentially have run the most horrific regime on earth. I don't know why we tolerate this, but we do. And unfortunately, the North Koreans are paying us back by threatening us with nuclear weapons and their long-range missiles.
Yeah, and now we, as the United States, we get tagged by the United Nations as crimes against humanity, but no one talks about the re-education camps or the treatment of the average citizen in North Korea.
Or citizens in China, for that matter. The UN has incredibly, not only double standards, but no standards whatsoever. That is a result of a number of factors, but unfortunately that's the way that it is. But people, countries like North Korea and China get free passes, and the United States doesn't. Makes no sense whatsoever.
Sir, why for so many years have we not had the backbone to just stand up, for America, our presidents and both parties? You know, why have we just been so gutless to basically say, to stand up for the republic?
I think that after we won the Cold War, as Henry Kissinger said, we took a vacation from history. And that's one of the few things that Kissinger has been right about. But essentially, that's right. I mean, we no longer believe, as Ronald Reagan, that the nature of regimes matters. And we are all in favor of trying to work with the Russia of Vladimir Putin, as well as the China of the Communist Party. And Kissinger has been a particular villain in this when it comes to China. So therefore, we believe that these great powers can all work together. Well, we can't, because as Ronald Reagan said, the nature of regimes matters. And until we relearn that lesson, and we're in no danger of relearning it, we are going to have very bad policies. We are going to have, we worry about al-Qaeda, and, we should, but al-Qaeda cannot really harm the United States. It's only countries with long-range missiles and nuclear weapons that can do that, and we should be worrying about the Chinas and Russias of the world as well as the al-Qaedas of the world, because at the end of the day, al-Qaeda does not have a nuclear weapon. It doesn't have a long-range ballistic missile, And while it can kill Americans, it can only kill them in the thousands, whereas China and Russia can kill us in the hundreds of millions.
Now, what you said now about al-Qaeda, I'm watching what's going on in Syria and Egypt. Is it possible that they can obtain them with the unrest that's going on over there now?
Well, the Assad regime doesn't have either long-range missiles or nuclear weapons, so no, the answer is they can't do that. The issues in Syria are really interesting, and there's a lot that can be said. You know, the Obama administration wants to arm the insurgents, which I think is absolutely the right thing to do, largely because the regime in Damascus is the best friend of Iran. And the way to get at Iran, if we want to do that without war, is to strip away its friends. And we can't strip away its friends as long as the Assad regime still rules Syria. But these are very complicated issues. And we are going to, you know, we're learning about the complex rivalries in the Middle East where there are no good solutions. There are absolutely no good solutions in Syria right now. What we need to do is pick from the least bad of them. And as I mentioned, I think that getting rid of the Assad regime is something we absolutely have to do, because if we don't do that, Iran will feel emboldened. And when Iran feels emboldened, we know what can happen.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, like you said, in Syria, there is no good solution, because when you say arm the rebels, which ones do you arm? You know, how do you pick and choose? Already, President Obama sent military weapons over to some of the rebels who ended up being associated directly with the Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda, and they ended up beheading a Catholic priest.
Yeah, I know. As I said, this is not a good story. But the alternative is you have a resurgent Iran, and Iran is on the well on its way to getting the nuclear weapons. And as much as I fear al-Qaeda, I fear Iran with a nuclear weapon much more, because Iran can destroy Israel. It can launch weapons that can completely upend the global system. And eventually, Iran has told us that they're coming after the United States. We can deal with al-Qaeda. We've dealt with al-Qaeda in many ways. We have yet to prove that we can deal with Iran.
All right, we got a caller in on the line. Let me bring this person on. Area code 816, you're on the air live with Southern Sense. Our guest is Gordon Chang. You have a question.
Hi, Annie. It's Thomas. How are you?
Hi, Thomas.
Okay, my question is this, and I wanted to find out if this was true or not about China. I was told probably a couple years ago that several years ago, like back in, I want to say about the 1940s or 50s, that China borrowed like $800 billion from us for something, and they have never paid that debt back. So if I'm looking at that in today's numbers, wouldn't what they owe us dwarf what we owe them in monetary value? I don't know if it was true or not, but a friend of mine who was into economics has shared that with me, so I wanted to ask you about that and if you knew anything about that.
That's a great question. I think what he's referring to are debts of the Republic of China, and actually even the debts of the Qing Dynasty, which fell in 1911. The People's Republic under Mao Zedong in 1949 repudiated debts of prior governments, so they do not acknowledge them.
Wow.
So basically the taxpayers are out that dough?
Well, it's not so much the taxpayers, but what you have are, for instance, bondholders. And if you want to, you can buy bonds of the Republic of China. You can buy them in New York. And in the expectation that they will be honored by the Chinese government. But, you know, the Chinese government has said that it's not responsible for those debts.
Oh, boy, and I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you.
Wow. That's crazy.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the stuff in doing the research I learned about China that I did not know about. I mean, even with the Immortal Eight and their families, and some of them actually now from these families have actually fled China and have now gotten green cards and citizenship here in the United States.
Excuse me. I mean, many of the Chinese, young Chinese of very wealthy communist royalty families live in the United States. Matter of fact, the daughter of Xi Jinping, the current ruler of China, goes to school in Boston. And the son or the daughter of Hu Jintao, the previous Chinese leader, went to school at Columbia, so in New York, which is where I am right now. So, yeah, I mean, you have many Chinese students in the United States, and they take advantage of the benefits of a free society, which is a good thing for us because they, in many ways, they support our educational institutions with tuition and other things, but also they do some things which aren't so good. So, for instance, many Chinese who stay in the United States and work here are actually working for Chinese intelligence, and so that's not a good thing.
Yeah, now, I was a police officer in Brooklyn, and right across the bridge was Chinatown, the Williamsburg Bridge, and we would have a lot of interchange with them. But there's such a closed society that, you know, it's impossible to get information from them.
Well, you know, this, you're talking about Chinatown. And then Chinatown, you know, does have a lot of closed societies and closed circles. But we're talking about broader Chinese immigration to the United States, where you have Chinese who have been integrated into American society. And those circles are not so closed. Those are actually, some of them are quite open. But nonetheless, they do present some important challenges to a democracy. And China, by that I mean Beijing, tries to influence Chinese students in the United States in ways which are completely inappropriate. And yet we have yet to deal with those challenges that Beijing mounts to us by virtue of its trying to control Chinese nationals who happen to live in the U.S.
Now, one of the things you're talking about, control of, you know, the United States through their citizens, the anchor babies. There is a huge tourism trade of women that are pregnant from China coming over here to have their babies so their babies are American citizens. And should we be worried about this in the future?
Actually, I don't think so. And the reason is that countries really do need people. You know, we're starting to see the very adverse demographic effects in Asia, especially in China. We're seeing it in Western Europe. The United States has favorable demography for a developed nation. We basically have a replacement total fertility rate, which is unusual among developed societies. This is very important for the U.S. to have to attract the best talent in the world. So I guess I'm not terribly upset about people wanting to come to the United States because these are people who want to be here and who are sometimes much more productive than American citizens who've been here for generations. So I tend to look at this as something which is we ought to be proud that people want to come to the U.S. and not be so concerned about it.
I hope so. Now, Mike, do you have a last question? Because we're coming down to our final 6 minutes.
Yes. How long – well, I don't know if it's a question. I'm going to throw something out there and kind of let you analyze it. At what point do we look at – will we turn on our TVs and this story will be another O.J. story or another – just everywhere and anywhere where you can't get away from it because the collapse has either happened, it's well underway, and kind of a part two to that question – what would be the best scenario for President Obama to do? What would be in America's best interest globally, financially, to do once those moments happen?
Well, I think that this will be an O.J. Simpson story within 6 months, maybe a little bit later, but I think that the fuse has been lit on the Chinese economy, and it's going to occur soon. Really, the best scenario, of course, is that they transition to a liberal democracy, but that's not going to happen. I think for President Obama, the best policy is just sort of wait and see and not try to support the Communist Party against its people because there is an argument in Chinese society, and we should be supporting the people, not the Communist Party.
Do you see like a repeat of Tiananmen Square?
That's a possibility. It doesn't have to work out that way. History sometimes doesn't repeat itself. But clearly the Communist Party is willing to use force against its people, and we should be doing all we can to prevent it, and if it does occur, to condemn it, and to condemn it much more than the administration of George H.W. Bush did, which actually supported the Communist Party after Tiananmen Square. That's shameful. That's one of the worst episodes in American diplomacy, and we need to make sure we don't repeat it.
Yeah, I remember
watching
that.
Is there any chance that maybe the army or the military will not go against the students or a rebellion if something along those lines were to happen again?
That's a real possibility, because I don't think the People's Army wants to do what it did in 1989. The Communist Party is not as legitimate today as it was at that point, and so I think there's less of an inclination to support the party, but we really don't know what the army is going to do. It really depends how the situation develops. You know, the Chinese military is like militaries everywhere. They see who's winning, and they jump on the winning side. We saw this 2 days ago with Egypt, and I think that we could see the same dynamics in China that we just saw in Egypt.
All right, one last question before we go, and I have to throw this out there because it's been sitting in the news for the last couple of days. Dennis Rodman.
He should not get the Nobel Prize, which he thinks he deserves. Dennis Rodman's weird. You know, I'm happy that he had a great time. But on the other hand, Kim Jong-un, the ruler of North Korea, was using Dennis Rodman, and we should never let the North Koreans use us. So if I were sitting on the Nobel Prize Committee, I wouldn't give it to Dennis Rodman.
Okay, I got to jump in, Mr. Gordon, before you go with this final question. What type of secrets, an educated guess, you obviously don't know the exact, but what kind of secrets is our friend Wiki there holding about what has the United States been doing to China that we don't want the Chinese to know?
Well, I think that we've been surveilling Chinese military and Chinese institutions. Unfortunately, everything that Snowden had on his thumb drive and his four laptops probably now is in the hands of Chinese intelligence. So, you know, the damage already has been done.
Well, Mr. Chang, I want to thank you so much. We're down to our final 3 minutes. This has been a fantastic and very informative interview, and I enjoyed it immensely. And you're welcome back anytime.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it as well.
Oh, thank you, my friend. Man, it seemed like the show went about 3 minutes.
It's always great when we have a great guest like Mr. Chan. So, Mr. Chan, again,
we'll
I welcome
this,
you back anytime.
We're going to post the links in your to buy your book in our chat room. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Wow.
That was Gordon Chan. And please check his website out, gordonchan.com. We got two guests coming up. Our next guest on Tuesday would be the Thomas Paine of the YouTube, Bob Basso. He is coming back. He'll be back with us again on Tuesday. Followed by Friday, we're going to have our friend Frank Salvato from the Basic Projects coming back again. So we've got great shows lined up. I hope you all join us again. Have a very safe and happy weekend. Enjoy your 4th of July, and remember the men and women who have fought to bring this holiday to us and this nation to us. So until then, I say good night and be safe, and God bless.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American. look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.